Hello, today is Friday, July 28th, 2017. I'm Joe Schmidt with TC2, and this is Staying Connected. We're going to talk about how your service provider treats network and data security. If you buy or maintain or use an enterprise network, I guess that's pretty much everyone listening, you know how important network security is to your company. Given the number of high-profile data breaches that have been reported, and you can bet that there are many more that haven't been reported, your company is hopefully going to great lengths to put the people, the processes, and the tools in place to protect the company's network and data. But something that doesn't always get the attention it deserves is how your service provider treats network and data security protections. So, to discuss this, I'm joined by Deb Bowling, a senior partner at LB3. I've had the good fortune of working with Deb for over 15 years, and she has many more years of experience than that advising clients on wireline and wireless telecom and technology agreements. Deb, it's good to have you here.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me on the program.
So, Deb, you published an excellent article this week describing some recent steps that AT&T took to address network and data security protections for its customers. Can you tell us about what AT&T did?
Sure, glad to. On July 13th of this year, AT&T added a general description of its security program and standards, as well as some regulatory compliance and data breach notice clauses to its online terms. Specifically, it added them to the general provisions portion. I'll describe AT&T's security program and data breach clauses in a moment, but first let me explain the AT&T online terms and how they apply to the services your organization buys and uses. The first thing you have to do is get into the lawyer speak, and a good contract will include what lawyers refer to as an order of precedence. And that order of precedence will make it so that the online terms, including these general provisions, don't apply if the contract that you've negotiated includes a provision addressing security and data breach. And that order of precedence is true in all contracts. For purposes of this discussion, AT&T's general provisions apply except if it's a signed contract or under AT&T's terms if there are service-specific terms that are more directed to the particular service that you are buying. I'm sure that a lot of you online are buying different services. Years ago, it would have just been a transport service, the MPLS of the world. But today, AT&T offers a wide variety of services. It resells lots of services, and it has 160 separate service-specific term requirements on its website. Those are thousands and thousands of pages of service-specific terms, so you might be nervous about, are those going to trump what information AT&T has provided in the general terms, security programs, and standards clauses? The good news, I suppose, is that you're likely not to have any service-specific terms on the data security provisions. That's good news that there's not worse terms, but it's a little surprising that there is not something that's a little bit better when you're talking about healthcare-focused services and managed security services that you're buying from AT&T. In that case, you might expect a lot of specifics about what's coming in, but AT&T doesn't do that. It says they will do specifics as in your written contract. So those are the couple pieces that are fitting together. Let's turn back then to the AT&T's online new security program. The general provisions provide a high-level description of AT&T's program. It talks about things like AT&T having a security program that's comprehensive, that's generally designed to make sure your information is protected, and it draws upon standards that will sound familiar, the ISOE and the IEC 27001, 2013. They also say, however, that their general security program differs based upon the type of data that is being distributed and the type of service that is being provided. That is probably the same, or it should be the same analysis that your company takes internally when it thinks about what data needs to be encrypted, what types of precautions need to be taken. On the upside, AT&T's general provisions and the new security program include a little bit of information about the types of control measures that they do have in place as part of their security program. They talk, for example, about network perimeter protection. They don't give you the details of what and where and how, but they do say that they install firewalls and they do general monitoring to see the traffic that is trying to get into their network. They also talk about things like workstation security. For example, if there are devices on which there is information that are portable, they will include a variety of protections. They will have full disk encryption. They will have things like anti-malware, and they will force updates on those portable assets to make sure that if somehow someone gets access to the information, it's not generally available. They will also do a generally appropriate physical access controls. So the physical access control would be sort of the locks on the door, the security desk that you may have to go through if you were entering into an AT&T location. And they'll make sure those are appropriate. They don't tell you what appropriate is, but they do say that they will have something in place. They also say that they'll have access to the information authorization controls. So the individuals that have access to certain types of information have to have appropriate credentials in order to get to that information, and that they also will remove the access once that individual no longer needs that information or has changed positions or other things. The problem is AT&T doesn't tell us when they're going to remove access. And, you know, this is one of those times when you hate to use the term, but you don't want a dismissed or a fired employee to go postal in terms not of harming individuals in the room, but in terms of stealing data that is important to AT&T customers. So you would want something that says access will be removed in an appropriate time frame. On the other hand, whereas AT&T was very general in terms of its new security program, AT&T provides more specifics on its regulatory compliance and data breach notices. But the specifics sometimes don't work in your favor. For example, AT&T is pretty detailed about what AT&T will not do in terms of monitoring your network and monitoring the data for data breaches. It is also very specific on the limits on the types of data breach notice it provides. For example, AT&T only monitors AT&T's network. It doesn't monitor anything that's specific to the data that you have. So if your concern is data going from a particular remote site back to the hub, AT&T isn't looking at that. It's looking generally at its network and whether or not there are breaches. It's not looking at anything that focuses on any vulnerabilities of your specific traffic. The more burdensome aspect of this is that AT&T doesn't provide the customer notice if whatever is going on in terms of unauthorized access to the data doesn't impact the services. And with the sophistication of the types of activity that are going on these days, there are very strong reasons to think that there may be a security breach that doesn't impact the services, meaning the services that the customer is receiving. And that would be very problematic for folks that have requirements under state privacy laws to provide notice to affected individuals. AT&T also reserves the right not to provide notice of a data breach if its determination says, nope, we don't think there was a data breach under applicable law. The laws applicable to AT&T may differ from the laws applicable to the customer. They may be different privacy laws in the states. They may also be different laws. For example, Gramm-Leach-Bliley doesn't apply directly to AT&T. So there are very big exceptions based on the way that AT&T has set up the regulatory compliance aspects of this deal.
So, it's good to know that somebody pays attention to those service guide changes. So with these changes, does AT&T provide specifics about its security program, or do they give a schedule of how often it tests its compliance with the program or how they maintain the program?
They don't. As we talked about, they give a very high-level program. But let me break your comment down into a couple areas, because you've talked about the testing compliance and then maintaining the program. So first, let's talk about, are there any specifics about the AT&T security program? No, there's nothing specific in terms of the control measures that are put in place. I mean, as we talked about before, it's all very high-level. There's something there, so if your contract is silent, it's certainly better than silence, but there are not specifics. And let me explain why AT&T does that, and there are some justifications for this. AT&T considers the specifics of its security program to be confidential. Whereas that's frustrating to a customer, it may indeed be something that there are just reasons for. I mean, think about coaching. You don't want the other team to know the way that you're going to approach your defense. You want to be very silent so that they can't come even better prepared. In that regard, AT&T doesn't want its competitors or hackers to know what it's doing to protect its network and the security of the data on its network. So there are some just reasons for that. But the other aspect of it is that AT&T doesn't want to generally disclose this to third parties, because even if you need it for these reasons and you are under a confidentiality obligation, it doesn't want it to be a leak, and AT&T doesn't want this to become widely known and to become public information. So it doesn't generally disclose to third parties, and that is something that is very important from AT&T's perspective, but frustrating from customers that may need access to the information. AT&T doesn't say this, but is from a lawyer's perspective, I think the reason it does not provide a lot of specifics is it wants a lot of wiggle room in terms of not having to defend itself against a claim that it has breached its contractual obligations with respect to the security of its network. The way it is set up, it has a lot of room to argue that it has met those requirements. Your next question, Joe, was with respect to how often, or are there any specifics on when and how AT&T tests and monitors its compliance with the security program? The only thing that AT&T says in this regard is that it regularly tests its security programs. But the problem with regularly is that regular can mean a bunch of different things to different people, or it can mean different things to the same people over a period of time. So, for example, Joe, do you regularly have a big birthday bash?
I have birthday bashes. It's up to my wife, but yes, I do.
And does your wife do this sort of regularly, or is this just a haphazard thing?
I think she'd probably call it regular.
Okay. Has this changed, though? You're now focusing on us as adults. Has this changed as you've gotten older? Was it different when you were young?
Yeah, I think there are more milestone birthdays now.
Well, Joe, I think that what you're saying is just a good example of how regularly is different to different people. If someone asks me if I have a regular birthday bash, I'm going to say yes. It so happens that right now my regular birthday bash is about every decade. And when I was a kid, a long time ago, a regular birthday bash was every year. The same thing is true of AT&T's testing of security controls. It says it does it regularly, but we don't know what that means to AT&T either right now. Does it do it every year, every decade, or every millennium? Or does it do it more frequently? And even if we knew what it did today, we don't know what it's going to do tomorrow. Just as my birthday went from annually to every decade, and it could go beyond that later, we don't know what AT&T will do in the future. We talked about the testing of the compliance, but the maintaining the security program is even less rigorous. AT&T says it regularly performs maintenance and it regularly does modifications to its security program, but it adds at AT&T's discretion. I mean, that's another, from a lawyer's perspective, that is another huge carve-out. Because if something's at your discretion, you can change it at any point in time. I mean, if I'm typically doing something, having a big birthday bash every decade, at my discretion, I can say, I'm not feeling so good about how I look this year, so we're going to wait until it's a quarter century mark. That's something I can do at my discretion, and no one can complain, because it was solely up to me. This lack of specifics on both the testing of the compliance with the security program, the maintenance and modifications of the security program, and the specifics about what is actually done is often inadequate for most public companies and for some private companies. For public companies, the inadequacy comes in large part from the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. It's an old act at this point, but that act made companies' management and their boards accountable for the truth in the financial data that they disclosed. And that makes it very focused, and everyone wants to make sure these things are in place. With that in mind, and the fact that financial data is released, you know, there are annual reports and those types of things, the SOX really requires that these controls and these monitoring and maintenance be performed no less than annually. And that is why most enterprise customers, particularly those that are in regulated industries, will require annual audits. And they will also require that those audits typically be performed by somebody independent of the vendor itself. They often require different standards. So we talked about AT&T offering ISO 27001. This is not the same. There are many clients and business customers that require ISAE 3402 or SSAE 16. Some of these are thought of as replacing the model clauses from way back when. The other issue that is very distinct and why this is not necessarily adequate for customers is that while the Sarbanes-Oxley and the requirements that the management must, you know, validate the veracity of the financial data, SOX focuses on a particular company's financial data. It doesn't focus on the general network issues. So the focus of AT&T in looking at its network and the security and how it performs is focusing on how it's performing generally. It is not necessarily focusing on how it looks at the individual customer's data, in that example that I gave of the hub and the remote site transmitting data.
So with the changes, does AT&T impose any obligations on their customers?
Probably indirectly. So let me explain what this sort of caveat means. AT&T, unlike some carriers that say customer must encrypt their data, Windstream, for example, has that in their online terms. AT&T doesn't directly require its customers to implement policies to safeguard their data against unauthorized access. But what they do is they say, look, don't rely on our security standards. They're there and they're good, but we're not warranting that that's going to keep you safe. You should go ahead and put in appropriate data security standards. And if you don't, then we may use that against you. It's one of those areas in which lawyers always want to think ahead of the game and come up with arguments that can be used if indeed there is a fight about whether something was properly done. So that is something that is just really important for folks to think about as they're going through this. And hopefully, to go back, Joe, to what you had mentioned earlier in this call, is hopefully everyone on this call, their company is already very carefully considering security requirements. And I'd be surprised, unpleasantly surprised, if you don't already have in safeguards that are appropriately designed to safeguard your data.
AT&T obviously is a very big service provider, but how do other big service providers handle network and data security protections in their contract?
The other service providers have taken different routes, and they're usually a bit more of a web that you have to work through. They include online terms and written contract terms, and many of those terms are online instead of having appropriate provisions in the contract. So let's go back through this. Let's look at the online terms first and the areas in which you should focus. What you want to focus on in the online terms are the security provisions. They don't really show up well in any vendor's terms other than AT&T's. And there are online terms for customer content. Those terms don't necessarily show up directly in AT&T's online terms, but customer content terms do show up in Verizon's online terms and in some of the other providers' online terms. And we'll get to the specifics. The other area in which you want to focus on is the limitation of liability and the disclaimers of damages. Let's look at Verizon. Verizon has the most complicated structure for trying to work through what are the security provisions related to your contract. Its structure is complicated because not only does it have the contract provisions, but Verizon scatters those terms in different places. It has some of those in a section which it is referred to as the content disclaimer. In that provision, Verizon says we don't have any responsibility for the content that the customer transmits or stores on our services or facilities. And that is a problematic provision because what it's saying is we have no responsibility, we have no liability, and now all the responsibility is on the customer. Verizon goes on to say that the customer stores and transmits the content at its own risk. Again, pushing aside any risk that Verizon could have on that. And for further belt and suspenders, Verizon says clearly that the customer is solely responsible for implementing security protection for the content that is stored with it, including anything that is related to health or financial content. So Verizon does offer, at a high level, some protection measures in terms of appropriate technical and organizational measures to protect regulated customer data against accidental or unlawful destruction or unlawful access. So that's helpful for a slim category of the content that's transmitted over the network, and it may make customers feel pretty comfortable. The problem, however, is that Verizon then goes back and takes away what it has just given. And how does it do that? It goes into a section that's called a content disclaimer. And in the content disclaimer, Verizon clearly says it has no responsibility for any content. And the content includes the regulated customer data that you were just feeling good about. It says it has no responsibility for any content that's transmitted or stored on Verizon facilities or services. And it goes on to say that it is not responsible for the level of security protection that customer uses for any particular content. Finally, as if that's not enough, it says customer is solely responsible for selecting and using the level of security and protection needed for the content that it's storing. So Verizon has given one thing, which was to the regulated customer data, and then pulled it right back with all of these other terms that are scattered in other provisions. That is why you have to dig deep and far to find the relevant provisions to see where you end up. Windstream and Sprint's online terms are not as confusing as Verizon's. They don't offer you something good equivalent to what you thought was Verizon's regulated customer data protections, but they offer you, or they include equivalent provisions that take away any liability for security of the customer data and for any confidential information that may go across the network. That's very problematic. The other part of the contract that we need to go to is the written contract, because we've talked about the organization of the order of precedence, and the other providers that don't have online terms, the level threes of, for example, the CenturyLink. CenturyLink actually has online terms. It just doesn't happen to have any that are specific to this particular issue. But for the other providers, the CenturyLinks, the level threes, the others out there, they rely on their contracts to protect them against claims related to unauthorized access to your information. They do that by including some of the concepts we were talking about before, the sole remedies, the limitations of liability, the disclaimers of damages, in their specific contract documents. They also will sometimes include security obligations solely on the customer. This is particularly true if you negotiate a statement of work for a managed security service, or if you don't negotiate that, if you look and dig down into the service-specific terms, there will indeed often be terms that will assign those responsibilities for the security of your services only on the customer.
Clearly, this is something that needs to be looked at by all enterprises, and you've provided a great deal of information here. But do you have any final advice on what enterprises need to do with their contracts to address data and network security?
At an average cost of breach in the United States of about $7.2 million, customers have to take network and data security seriously. You have to walk through these provisions very carefully, and you have to make sure that you follow the path and you follow them through. It can be a very frustrating process, but the recommended way to address this, which can be extremely difficult, just to be quite honest, is to negotiate provisions in the written contract that addressed network and data security and breach notice provisions instead of relying on the online terms. And as a final measure, you'll want to sign up for the service guide updates if they're available and when they're available, because even though there's a lot of stuff that you won't be interested in, once in a while, a vendor will post something that can be beneficial, and if it's not beneficial, is at least intriguing.
Well, thanks, Deb, and thank you for listening. If you'd like to learn more about this important topic or would like to discuss other issues that are affecting your company, please give us a call.